WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Danny Aiello is starring in a new TV series that premieres Tuesday on CBS. He plays a cop turned private eye. His son, Rick, co-stars. On this archive edition, we have a 1992 interview with Danny Aiello. Aiello is a great actor with no formal training, but he has plenty of what's called life experience. He used to work for Greyhound Bus and was the president of the union local. After a dispute with management, he was out of a job, and when he needed money real bad, he stole it. Then he worked as a bouncer at several clubs. He didn't start acting until his mid-30s. He got his breaks in the films Purple Rose of Cairo as Mia Farrow's husband, Moonstruck as Cher's intended, and Do the Right Thing as Sal, the owner of the pizzeria. I spoke with him after the release of his film Ruby, in which he played Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald after Oswald was imprisoned for assassinating JFK. Aiello told me he remembers watching Ruby shoot Oswald live on TV.
I went, yip, yip, hooray. I believed at that time, Terry, in street justice, an eye for an eye. He killed our president, and this guy killed him. Good. That's how I felt. And this, of course, was the germ of the idea where I began to formulate the character of Ruby. I made him in my own mind a hero. And as we know, the way Ruby ends up, we find out that he's really not a hero, and he's realizing it toward the end of his life. But that was my reaction.
When did you stop thinking hip, hip, hooray?
Well, hip, because, you know, I still have a feeling about Ruby. I feel that he murdered this guy, but I truly feel that he was a victim as well of the kind of a person he was. He was a very ingratiating person. He was a chameleon kind of person. He was a person who brushed shoulders with many, many kinds of people. And whenever he did that, assuming that it was a wise guy, he would attempt to take on the persona of a wise guy. If he was on a stage introducing an act, he suddenly became Dale Carnegie with a southern twinge in his voice, therefore placating his audience. And if he was with an intellectual, he would become or attempt to become that kind of a person. He was a person that was looking for acceptance all of his life, I feel. And through my investigation of the character and a little that there was on Ruby, I formulated this kind of character, which I thought would be complex and very nice to do. He never left me. He has never left me. The word hero might not be the correct one, but he's never left me as a guy who did what he had to do. The reason, if I do call him a hero and feel that he was a hero, I don't know exactly when I stopped feeling that way. I don't know if I entirely have stopped feeling that way. But he was a guy who did something he felt, in my opinion, was patriotic. He did something which he felt was going to uplift his race of people, which are Jewish people. This is what I feel. He did something that he thought was heroic, only later to find out that people didn't think he was a hero. He thought they stole from the American people. He stole from the American people the opportunity of finding out what actually did happen. And as a result of that, they felt that he was a conspirator. And I think from that point on was when his downfall was, and he slowly died from then on.
You portray Ruby as a small-time guy who's gotten in over his head.
Absolutely.
And who often has to bluff his way out of tight situations. And you do wonderful line readings in the movie. I mean, I think you just convey a lot with your voice and with where you put the accents in certain readings of lines. I wonder how you rehearse these things, even at home. And I don't even necessarily mean on the set, but when you got this script and you were trying to figure out how you would do the character, how you would do specific lines, what's your process like for testing out your line reading?
I wish I had a process. I do it until I learn it, and I don't learn it. I'm talking about line by line by line. I don't memorize it to the extent where it's like rote. It's always got to be fresh and new to me. I like to go before the cameras knowing the lines, but I'm not totally sure of them. Do you follow what I mean? So that when they do come out of my mouth, they appear to be coming out of my mouth for the first time. I don't know what the system is. People at the American Academy asked me to come over and teach. I said, what am I going to teach? They said, the Aiello system. I said, what is that? I have no way of defining it. All I know is I sit by myself with myself. I work on the script, and it's a matter of repetition, constantly going over the entire script, interrelating with other characters, what other characters mean to me. And then I find, after making all the plans that I can, when I'm finally going before the cameras opposite the other actor, things change. And they all start all over again, and it's probably nothing that I've been rehearsing. But I like to go in there with that feeling that I'm not quite sure what all the lines are, so that it comes out not like rote, as I said before.
You started acting when you were in your mid-30s. Did you have any idea before that you were even interested in acting?
No, I gravitated toward acting, Terry, because I thought it might be, it's a communication media, and I was a fairly good talker, and I was fairly good with people, that maybe this would be the way to go. I was uneducated. I was in high school for about a half hour. I went in one door and out the other. I went to James Monroe. So I really had no education, no trade. So I felt that the obvious place to go after losing the union job would be into acting, never realizing how difficult that profession is. But I did it anyway. But I never thought I would be a failure. I always thought to some level I would be a success if I dedicated myself. And look what happened, you know.
I'm interested in your early life. Your father was a teamster and was on the road a lot.
Yeah, my father was not home. We had what could be perceived as a fatherless home.
Right.
Amanda would come home once a year, impregnate my mother, have a steak while we all ate macaronis and beans. But Mama managed to find a steak for him somehow, and he ate it. He ate it very proudly at the table while we ate macaroni and beans. But it was my mother who was solely responsible for the bringing up of 7 children.
I know you went to work when you were very young, but I think you also got involved in robberies when you were pretty young,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I did some crazy things. I had a fear, Terry, of being homeless, and that was early on. I don't know when that was put in my mind. I guess maybe if Mama decided to run off like Dad did, then the 7 kids would have been homeless. So I guess that was the germ of the idea in my mind. And as I grew up and I lost my union presidency job, and there was very little for me to, you know, I was making $190 here, then I was making nothing. I got frightened, and I thought I wasn't going to be able to keep a roof over the heads of my 4 children and my wife and myself. And I did things to compensate for that, and they were not armed robberies. They were not hitting people over the head. They were some maybe deserted buildings where there might be a safe. I did some silly, stupid things that I feel ashamed I did, and I hate to even talk about them in public because it sends out mixed signals. It's like the dope addict who says, look, you kids can don't start dope, you know, but he's telling a kid not to start dope when he was a dope addict and is now telling people he got off of it and he's a famous person, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly.
So I don't like to send out those messages, but the fact is that was my life. And I try to justify it by saying, you know, I was desperate, I thought we were going to be homeless, and that was the only way I can turn, because at that point in my life, it was pretty hard for me to have no money coming in and supporting a family of 6. 4 children, my wife and I.
Did you make sure the statute of limitations was up before mentioning
it
publicly?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. What a wise son of a gun I am, but I did. And, you know, I don't want you to think that it was like this was an ongoing thing forever. It was a thing that happened until the fear became so great in me that I said, I just can't do this, because what I would be doing is losing my family anyway if I did have to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And things, just as God wants, started to work out. See, I had the problem, I never wanted to borrow money from anyone. I wouldn't take money, I wouldn't ask, I wouldn't accept help from anyone. And the only help that I did accept was something that really set me off to stealing, and that was welfare. I didn't have the guts to go into the welfare office. My wife did. Twice on welfare for 2 months. My wife stood in line, humiliated, right? And she came from a family that had money. She was humiliated, and she stood there. And I swore I would never do that again. So when we started to get destitute again, I refused to go back there. So the next thing that I did was decide to make money in another way. Sandy had no idea I did it. She thought I was hustling pool again because I was an expert pool shooter, billiard shooter at the early time of my life. So I was telling Sandy lies as to where I was getting the rent money. There were times that I was 4 or 5 months behind in my rent, and I was afraid we were going to be homeless again. So I would go out and do something, and I'd break into cigarette machines, jukeboxes. I used to pay rent with quarters and nickels and dimes. It's crazy, and I'm ashamed to tell you this, Terry. And I don't want you to think any less of me for it, but I'll tell you, people do that, and we can be critical and should be critical because no one should have to do that. But sometimes you get so desperate and you have no one to turn to ask the advice, and you go out and do it.
So what was the job that got you out of this?
Well, the acting started to come more and more, and I started bouncing in Roseland, and I took other bouncing jobs to supplement my earnings. Then, of course, the improvisation again. Then I began getting Broadway shows, acting jobs. Remember, the first acting jobs I got were on a stage, and they were off Broadway. They were so off, it was like in a Bronx somewhere. And they were paying very, very little money, if not any money at all, you know. They were like Equity Productions, 13 performances. The fortunate thing is a writer by the name of Louis LaRusso had written me 3 off-Broadway plays. And I gave back his audition, and each one of those plays, I took to Broadway and starred in each of them.
My guest is Danny Aiello. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1992 interview with Danny Aiello.
You know, we were talking about bluffing. The way you play Jack Ruby, he has to bluff his way through a lot of situations. I'm wondering, when you started to act, did you have to bluff your way into acting? Did you have to make it seem like you really knew what you were doing, even though you had no experience?
Terry, I never studied one day in my life as an actor. I never went to school. I was a man in a hurry. I started at 35. I felt schooling at this point to learn how to act is not what I need. If I don't know how to get up there and recreate things that I've had or have experienced on the street, then I have a serious problem. So I was a man in a hurry. The bluffing came where you had to lie, unfortunately, like most actors beginning do. They put on their resume, some phony resume, because when you go in without a resume, you sit there with an agent. He said, "What have you done?" And you say, "Well, I haven't done anything yet." He said, "Well," I said, "Well, you get in what they call a catch-22. You can't get an agent unless you've done something. You can't get a job unless you have an agent. So what do you do?" You know, somewhere along the line, someone has to believe that you can do it. Someone's got to be willing to give you that job.
What would you do at auditions to try to impress casting directors?
Well, auditions for me were horrific. I don't know that I've ever got a job in my life auditioning. I usually got my jobs talking head-to-head with the director. He got to know about me, I got to know about him. But auditioning, even at this time, 7 years ago I decided I will never audition again. I will never put the power in anyone's hands and tell them they haven't got it, I have got it. I am a firm believer, if I was a director, there is not an actor in the world that I couldn't cast for a movie if I was directing it by simply sitting opposite him and talking to him and having a conversation and being able to decide at that moment that I can work with this man and I can get what I want on the screen from this man. Reading of roles and trying to be someone at a cold reading or even a prepared reading is never what a good actor ends up doing anyway.
Because it's so contrived?
All baloney.
Yeah.
All you're doing is teaching the director and those other people who was his hangarounds want to learn about the character.
You know, one of your really big breakthrough roles was as Sal in Do the Right Thing. And I really loved you in that film. And I always felt watching that movie that Spike Lee probably saw the character as a blatant racist, but that you gave the character a depth and integrity. And I know you actually even wrote lines for the character to flesh the character out. But it was as if Spike Lee didn't notice that the character had changed by virtue of your interpretation of it. And so in the meantime, all the plot was proceeding as if you were this one-dimensional racist, when in fact the character you were playing was no longer that.
Yeah, if you pick up his original script, the original, you'll see that he was a one-note character. To me, he was what I would have called in the old days a token black in an all-white film. In this case, he could have been a token white and an all black film. When I looked at it, I told Spike, I said, this guy's a plantation owner. This guy's a boring character. Why is he there? Why is he in Bed-Stuy? Why has he got a pizzeria and in a totally black neighborhood? I said, he can be anywhere. So I defined in my own mind that he's there because that's where he wants to be. He likes the people. He enjoys the people he's working with. He saw them get older. He enjoys the fact that they love his food. He's that kind of a simple guy, and it was because of that, I think, that made the character a more sympathetic character, and they're a multi-dimension character, as opposed to a simple out-and-out racist. Now, you may define in your own mind or come to the conclusion that Sal is a racist, but it's not obvious.
But do you think that Spike Lee maybe didn't even notice how the character was changing? In other words, I always felt that the movie proceeded, the plot proceeded as if some of the people were acting to you like you were this just one-note racist, which the character no longer was.
Well, that may be the ability to people to either respond as actors or not be able to respond to what it is they're hearing. You know what I mean? With Spike, I have to give him this. Before I agreed to do this, I said I wanted to make some changes. He said, anything you want to do to make it better. That's what Spike said. And he went with the program as we were going. See, there was one part of the film at the end where it bothered me that Spike's character, Mookie, said to Sal, my character, what are you arguing about after the place was burned? Are you going to get your money back on insurance? I was infuriated by that remark because you cannot, as a store owner, as a business owner in Bed-Stuy, get insurance. So I said, this is a joke. Why are you saying that? I said, I want to come back. Well, what are you kidding? I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. He didn't want that line in. So I had to write this other line. This isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Do you remember that line? So he compromised somewhat. He didn't want me to say I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. But he did permit me to say, this isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Anything anyone ever tells me could never make me believe that Sal was an out-and-out racist. What Sal is a realist. If a man, forgive my language, or anyone who may be offended, looks at Sal and calls him a guinea, Sal will in kind come back and call you a nigger, a spick, a mick, a kite. Do you follow what I'm saying? He would go to the core of trying to hurt that person as that person just tried to hurt him. That's the honesty of Sal.
Danny Aiello, recorded in 1992. He plays a cop turned private eye in the new TV series Della Ventura, which premieres Tuesday on CBS.